When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is an RNZ podcast.
Nga mihi nui. I'm Alison Balance and welcome to this Our Changing World podcast from RNZ. On the 22nd of February 2011, Christchurch experienced a severe earthquake, resulting in much loss of lives, destruction and liquefaction. Over the past few months, we've been talking with experts about what we've learned from events like this. Misko Subranovsky is a University of Canterbury geotechnical earthquake engineer. He's interested in how the ground, and consequently how buildings and other structures such as pipes, respond to shaking. His speciality is liquefaction, which was a notable feature of both Canterbury earthquakes. Misko is part of the Quake Core Centre of Research Excellence. He was involved in SCIRT, the Stronger Christchurch Infrastructure Rebuild Team, which was created immediately after the 2011 earthquakes, to rebuild Christchurch's damaged horizontal infrastructure, think water and sewage pipes. I meet Misko in his office at Canterbury University and begin by asking him to describe liquefaction.
Liquefaction is a ground response during earthquakes, in which the ground pretty much turns from a solid matter into a fluid medium, and as a consequence it becomes very soft, very deformable, and is affecting detrimentally land and structures. Liquefaction always results in large ground movements, and those movements are damaging for both land, small buildings, large buildings, as well as buried infrastructure.
Yeah, so that moment where the ground turns from solid to liquid doesn't last for very long, but the consequences of what happens during that phase last for a long time.
Exactly. Actually, development of liquefaction is only a few seconds during strong earthquakes. So during the February 2011 earthquake, it took 2, 3, 4 seconds to liquefy the loose soils in the eastern suburbs of Christchurch. And then there is a period of a minute or two where that effect of liquefaction remains very strong, during which large deformations and effects occur. And then it takes really hours and days for the soil to get back to the equilibrium state. But the consequences of liquefaction are extremely severe. And as you rightly pointed out, we still feel them 10 years later.
So during something like the Christchurch earthquake, when there was widespread liquefaction, how deep down is that going?
The liquefaction usually can go quite deep, but the most damaging liquefaction is close to the ground surface. And in Christchurch, we were focusing on the top 10 meters, and in particular, the top 5 meters of the ground are really the most damaging. In some cases, you may get liquefaction at larger depths, 15, 20 meters. And in those cases, the effects of liquefaction will be much less damaging. Actually, quite often, and that is one of the results of our in-depth studies, you find that liquefaction at large depth can prevent manifestation of liquefaction effects on the ground surface. So actually can serve as a mitigating factor for liquefaction damage. And that was one of the great findings of our research, I would say, where we explained why in some areas, despite the fact that there are liquefiable soils close to the surface, the effects of liquefaction were negligible or non-existent. So in that sense, where does liquefaction occur first is critical for the response of the ground and effects on structures.
So if you get a layer of liquefaction that's quite deep, it can be protective in a sense.
Correct. You have deep liquefaction once that soil behaves in a fluid-like manner. Then it basically acts as an isolation mechanism. So the earthquake waves hitting that layer are going to actually reduce in amplitude. And as a consequence, you're getting different types of response at the surface and different level of shaking. And that minimizes the loads to the structure. Depending on the type of the structure, those loads can be detrimental, but in many cases, they are beneficial. And surely, in those cases, if deep liquefaction occurs, the ejecta, the liquefied soil, may not reach the ground surface. So you will have absolutely no evidence at the ground surface that something happened at the depth.
Now, to get liquefied soil, you need liquid in there. So what are the characteristics of the ground that make it susceptible to liquefaction?
So there are a few major ingredients in the cookbook for liquefaction. So first, you need to have liquefiable soils. And those are typically sandy soils, like silt, sand, and gravels are those type of soils that are liquefiable. Clays are non-liquefiable. So once you have liquefiable soil, then they have to be saturated with water. So the groundwater, which we don't see, actually is filling the voids of the soil in the ground, and quite often it's quite high. So the water table, the top of the groundwater, is approaching the ground surface. So in Christchurch, the water table is just 1 to 2 meters below the ground surface, meaning everything beneath that depth is fully saturated, or all the voids in the ground are filled with water. So now, if the soils that are liquefiable and fully saturated are relatively loose, when shaken by the earthquake, they tend to densify. So that kind of response of the ground is creating actually pressure in the groundwater. And that positive pressure is then separating the ground particles, and the soil loses its structure and becomes a viscous fluid. And that is how liquefaction develops. So liquefiable soils, loose, fully saturated, shaken by strong earthquakes, are the four ingredients you need to get liquefaction.
Were you here during the Christchurch earthquake?
Yeah, I was actually exactly in this office.
And at that point in time, what was your understanding of liquefaction and what would you have thought about it as a possible threat to Christchurch?
Well, I had very good understanding of liquefaction. It has been the subject of my research throughout my whole career, so for nearly 40 years. So the shaking was so strong, all of these books from the shelves went down. It was immediately obvious to me that this was a very damaging event, and that I was expecting to see a lot of damage to structures, and certainly liquefaction was something that I was expecting, knowing the very high liquefaction potential of Christchurch soils. I was still surprised when I saw it because, you know, I have gone to reconnaissance missions to maybe 10, 15 major earthquakes, and I have seen a lot of liquefaction effects throughout the world, including 5 or 6 major events in Japan, because I lived in Japan for 15 years. So I was surprised by how extensive and widespread the effects of liquefaction were. And probably it is the largest urban liquefaction on record in the world. We have 30, 40, 50% of the city area affected by liquefaction. So no one was prepared for something like that. The sheer magnitude and the extent of liquefaction was still surprising even for me. But of course, I could easily explain it.
So what did you do after the earthquake in terms of getting out and doing research?
So the first week, actually, I spent with one of my students, Eric Taylor. We spent about a week driving through the city and trying to map the severity of liquefaction throughout the city. And we produced the first liquefaction map. Because, you know, one of the things that we know quite well is that effects of liquefaction, the evidence of liquefaction is perishable. You lose it within a week or two. So we had to go quickly in the field and to capture evidence of liquefaction, which is going to quickly disappear. And that was really the initiation of our long-term research. And it went through different phases. In the following 3 or 4 months, I was in the field with all my students and colleagues, researchers, to really understand the effects of liquefaction on different structures. We call those case histories. So for each case history, we had to document what exactly happened, what are the residual deformation, what kind of movements occur in the ground, on the structure, what was the damage to the structure. And then after finishing that phase of understanding what happened during the earthquakes, we go into another phase where we perform field and laboratory investigations now to characterize the ground where this happened so that we associate certain type of damage and manifestation to certain ground conditions. So that phase was quite long, as you would understand. A lot of testing was done in the field and in our laboratories. Then we move into the next stage, which is we use now that data that we have compiled from field investigations and the observations, and we do analytical studies now to use mathematical models to explain what happened and to see how good our models are. These are type of models and procedures that engineers would typically use in practice. Some are simple and used on a daily basis, and some are very advanced and used for very special and important structures. So we really try to go through that kind of process through first understand what happened, then characterize the ground so that we have enough input for detailed assessment so that we can scrutinize existing procedures and improve them. Our final goal is to improve those procedures. And we apply to that to a very wide spectrum of structures and ground conditions, starting from residential buildings and residential land, CBD buildings, so multi-story buildings, horizontal infrastructure, bridges, potable and wastewater networks, buried pipelines. So really we covered all the important structures and infrastructure services for the city because they all did require special attention. There was huge damage to all of those. So that was our overall process, and we are now at a point where we can identify key findings and identify some key aspects of behavior that allow us to make major changes in the engineering procedures, including guidelines that provide important input to engineers in their evaluation process.
Can you give me an example or two of that?
Oh, there are several examples. The first quick example was the work of SCIRT and the effort to recover potable water service and wastewater services of Christchurch. They need to do that quickly because they need to reinstate services as quickly as possible. So there was no time for some in-depth and long-term research. So they were pretty much saying somewhere in March and April when we had the first meetings, they were like, look, we are repairing the infrastructure. We are spending $50 million a month. But we really don't have well-established procedures for how to treat liquefiable ground because this suddenly occurred. So the first thing we did was, based on the liquefaction map that I did mention before, we developed a liquefaction zoning map which was providing key details for design of buildings and infrastructure against liquefaction problems. And that was pretty much provided to SCIRT somewhere in June, July 2011, very, very quickly. Other particular instances where we improved guidelines is our understanding of the importance of system response effects or interactions between different layers in the deposit, which is related to the previous discussion on deep liquefaction. We identified that even when you have similarly weak deposits close to the surface, it's important what is beneath those deposits and how those deeper layers respond. And we have identified actually a number of typical deposits and interaction mechanisms that intensify liquefaction manifestation, where the deposit or the system is going to make things worse, as opposed to deposits and systems where they mitigate liquefaction manifestation. So despite having something very weak close to the ground surface, you're getting completely opposite effects, very severe liquefaction on one hand and no manifestation of liquefaction at all on the other hand. So that is one significant contribution, which is now pretty much becoming a standard consideration in the assessment of liquefaction and a very important one.
So for something like water pipes, wastewater pipes, drinking water pipes, is the idea that you just have to avoid particular areas, or is there particular mechanisms that you can use as you're laying the pipes that will allow them to, I don't know, flex or move? Yes. Or do what they need to do?
That's a very good point. And, you know, engineering solutions are always a spectrum of solutions. Avoiding the land is one of them. And then there are many other engineering solutions which require smaller or larger intervention to get where you want to be in terms of performance. And obviously, if the ground is with very high liquefaction potential, then the question is how much investment and are you prepared to go into something that is going to fully mitigate? And the answer to that is no. So it's always mitigation is never trying to make things bulletproof and safe against liquefaction, but it's trying to achieve performance that is acceptable for the present society, which means we are going to have limited investment in better performance, considering that, you know, always the money for that kind of intervention is either limited or non-existent. So really the engineering solutions are trying to find the optimal solution for a given time. Portable water and those kind of services are really critical services for a city, and you don't want to compromise too much there. But for example, one way of dealing with it is to use flexible pipes. Flexible pipes are just going to allow more relative ground movement, which will result in less damage. Then it's important how to use the joints, how to connect the pipes. If the joints are again flexible, allow relative movement between the pipes. Instead of snapping at the joint, you will have still service available despite the ground movement. Then how you build the trench. The trench can be less densified or more densified. If you make it more densified, it is going to better protect the pipe. What is the soil around the trench? So all those are important factors. And if we understand each of those, we can kind of anticipate what is going to happen during a small, moderate size, or very strong earthquake. And on that basis, then we can decide what is the acceptable solution. So it's always really engineering is all about those kind of evaluations and considerations and picking up the best solution for a given time and societal expectations and capacity for investment.
So when we say liquefaction, we tend to think of Christchurch now. What other New Zealand cities are prone to liquefaction, though, which need to be learning from the lessons that Christchurch learnt the hard way?
As I said, there are several important ingredients, liquefiable soil, fully saturated, and also you need to have earthquakes of significant size which are affecting the area. And unfortunately, New Zealand does have many of those places. The situation in some cities is very similar to Christchurch, but then you have quite significant differences as well. For example, let's take Wellington, one of the bigger ones. The liquefaction in Wellington is affecting different soils. It's really all to do about reclaimed land and the liquefaction along the waterfront. Those are reclamations created in the last 150 years. Some of those are quite recent, the largest ones, where the port is, for example, was reclaimed in the 1960s, 1970s. And they are quite thick. Some of those fields are 10, 20 meters thick. Unfortunately, they are composed of liquefiable soils, much of those, not all of them, but much of those reclamations. And they are relatively loose because the way they were constructed, they were simply dumping soils in the sea. So they are loosely deposited without any compaction. Of course, they are fully saturated because they were dumped in the sea. And we know that Wellington has very high seismic hazard. So clearly, we are expecting, and we saw during the Kaikoura earthquake, severe liquefaction developing in some of those fields. So we have very intensive research studies on the Wellington waterfront at the moment. And the key there is really to try to understand how liquefaction is going to develop in the waterfront area for different sizes of earthquakes. If we have good understanding of that, then we can either mitigate some of the very severe instances where liquefaction is occurring, or do alternative ways of treatment, or even abandon some area if we think it's too expensive to mitigate. So the first thing is really to understand what is going to happen for different sizes of earthquakes. Once we know that, we would know how likely or frequently liquefaction episodes are going to occur. And then on that basis, as a society, engineers are going to pretty much enforce the decision of the society, what we want to do, and then we can do our design for pretty much everything or anything that we face. It's a matter of how big is the cost going to be in order to achieve the performance that is the one expected from people. Wellington waterfront, that is a very intensive study and extremely demanding. So we have performed over 200 CPTs, which are field investigations in the waterfront area, covering pretty much the whole port and most of the waterfront.
So is that you drilling down?
Yes, you're pushing a cone and you're trying to understand what is the resistance of the ground. And on that basis, we are able to identify what types of soils we are dealing with and at what density state they are. Then we go, we recover samples, we bring them in the lab, we test them here, try to understand what the behavior of the of that material is, and then we go through the modeling process that I mentioned before. So we have just finished the simplified assessment, and we are now moving into advanced analysis. In advanced analysis, we will be able, for example, to model the whole reclamation. We can put some wharves next to it, we can put buildings on top of it, and we will shake all of it and see how different elements and systems as whole are going to behave to different sizes of earthquakes.
Can you densify liquefaction-prone soil? I'm thinking, can you compact it in some way to make it less prone?
Yes, and that is one of the most fundamental mechanisms that is used in ground improvement, densification, and that was actually done. So the reclaimed land around Te Papa was densified in that way, where a huge weight was dropped from 30 meters height on the reclamation, and in that process the weight was sinking in the ground for a meter or so, which is densifying the soil. So yeah, densification is one of the principal and probably easiest to implement approaches, though some of those are difficult to execute in present society because of the environmental impacts on surrounding structures. There are different and more sophisticated technologies as well.
Such
you,
as?
You can insert additional soil in the ground during vibration, which is going to obviously densify the surrounding soil because you're increasing the solid mass of the soil in the ground. You can build underground walls by mixing soil with cement, which is going to solidify the ground. You can then create different compartments and use different geometries to achieve the performance that you're aiming to achieve. There is a chemical ground improvement where you're using different matters, including some bacteria, to solidify the ground. And those are, let's say, some of that is in the research domain. But there are all sorts of different ideas how to improve the ground and make it less prone to liquefaction.
Thanks, Misko. Misko Subranowski is a University of Canterbury geotechnical earthquake engineer, and he's a member of QuakeCorps. This story is part of a series looking at what we've learnt from major disasters, and you can find links to other episodes at rnz.co.nz/ourchangingworld. Kei te whakaronga mai koe ki tō tātou au horihori, hei hōtaka e pāniki tō tātou au whānui. I'm Alison Balance, and you're with Our Changing World on RNZ. I'm Alison Balance, and this Our Changing World podcast from RNZ first aired on the 11th of February 2021. You can find photos and links at our webpage, rnz.co.nz/ourchangingworld, and the subscription link for our free email newsletter is at the bottom of the page. You can also subscribe to us as a podcast, RNZ Science, wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, do check out the podcast tab at rnz.co.nz. There is some great audio and video there on a wide range of topics. We're on Facebook and Twitter as RNZ Science. Many thanks for your company. Catch you next time. Ngā mihi.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.